Okay, we'll get started with the third of today's lectures. And the topic is the moral economy debate. This is the first of four topics coming out of my study of China studies. So it's kind of another theme within this course, but it's also a theme which is very closely related to the first lecture today and also the second lecture today. So there's a nice kind of coming together of topics among these three lectures. Before I dive into the lecture, I think I'll give you a little bit of context. The context is that I found in my own scholarly development about 15 years ago, I was very interested in these ideas of how philosophy and the social sciences and the theories of explanation to be found within the social sciences, how these things kind of connected together. And I was very interested in coming up with some good examples of applied social science research which raise some of these questions about explanation and rationality and institutional explanations and so forth. And so I became interested in a set of issues that were and still are important within Asian studies in my country. Asian studies is the discipline that studies China, Japan, India, Indonesia, etc. Mostly from the point of view of peasant and agricultural and agrarian structure. So what I undertook to do was to research a series of topics that were important in the field of Chinese history. And then I wrote the book that you've read now a little bit of called Understanding Peasant China. But the idea was to pick out some important theoretical debates and as a philosopher to really get my hands into those debates, to understand them very well, and then to try to sort them out and try to help myself, but also help the practitioners, the people writing these theories, understand better what the logical connections are within those debates. Now, it has turned out that this is a very productive thing to do. The historians and the sociologists of China have been very receptive to the analysis that I, as a philosopher, have offered, and I certainly have learned an enormous amount by interacting with them. A lot of the ideas that I learned through my study of Chinese history, I have now folded into my theory of, for example, methodological localism and micro-foundations. So as a philosopher, I feel my philosophy of social science has been very much influenced by the struggle of intellectual learning, which I've done in trying to understand some parts of Chinese history. And I think that it also has been somewhat useful for some Chinese historians to have a philosopher commenting on and observing the work that they do. The moral economy debate is one really important debate within Asian studies. It's a debate between two schools of thought, between the rational peasant theory, which tries to explain Asian developments, Chinese, Southeast Asian, East Asian developments, along the lines of rational choice theory, and the moral economy view, which is associated with a man that we'll introduce you to in just a minute, James Scott, the moral economy view, which says that peasant communities in Southeast Asia, in particular, are organized around a shared ethic which leads them to behave in ways which are community-oriented rather than just rationally self-interested. So it's really a division of opinion between people who understand Asian history as a pure example of rational calculation on the part of peasants, and those who think that the big developments in Chinese history or Asian history have to take into account ethical ideas, and in particular what is referred to as a subsistence ethic, which says that peasants have a shared set of assumptions about justice, which say that landlords and the state should respect their rights of subsistence, and that peasants will in turn act or refrain from acting depending on whether that subsistence ethic has been honored. Now, this disagreement between the rational peasant theory and the moral economy theory is applicable to lots of different kinds of social behavior. It's applicable, for example, to the question, where are villages likely to be located? Are they located along rivers, or are they located up on mountaintops? Well, that's a kind of simple example of rational choice theory. If you were a peasant cultivator, would you choose to put your village or your house on the top of a mountain or near the river? Well, there are a lot of advantages of being near the river. The land is more fertile. The waterway means cheap transportation. And so we would expect rational individuals would choose to live more conveniently rather than less conveniently. Therefore, we would expect settlement to occur along transportation routes, not on the tops of mountains or in isolated valleys. That would be an example of rational choice theory explaining an important social phenomenon, the location of settlements in the countryside. And that actually, in a separate chapter of Understanding Peasant China, I go through the implications of economic geography for the regional structure of China, which is a separate story. But the point I'm making is that the rational peasant theory and the moral economy theory are relevant to a number of topics. The topic that I'll focus on, though, is peasant rebellion. Peasant mobilization, peasant activism, peasant involvement in organized movements, and the eventual occurrence of peasant rebellion and peasant collective action. Now, where does this all come from? The question is really, why do peasants behave as they do? We can do sociology, we can do anthropology, we can go and observe peasant behavior, whether it's in routine decision-making about farming methods and crops, or decisions whether to join or to support a collective project. Why do peasants choose to behave as they do? What is the range of private activity and collective activity? And what motivates peasants to involve themselves in collective activities, whether it's village-wide celebrations or it's a widespread peasant rebellion or peasant movement? What is it that motivates the peasant? I simply make the observation that a village society is a highly complex mix of activities, from common labor done on the farm, private farming, ceremonial activities, tiger hunts, I was referring to the tiger hunt a little earlier, militias for self-defense, involvement in protest and rebellion. All these are examples of everyday, and maybe not quite so everyday, forms of peasant activity. And the question again, theoretical question, what is it, what assumptions about individual decision making can we make that will explain these patterns of behavior? It is also worth noting that in villages, in rural society, we find a complicated mix of patterns of cooperation and competition. It's a very interesting thing. It's one of the reasons why I have found the study of peasant societies and rural social life so interesting, is that it's a great example of a place where both social cooperation and social ties, but also competition and economic competition and inter-family, inter-individual competition takes place. So what are some forms of cooperative social behavior? Reciprocity is a good example. It's an important word, but it's also a good example. What is reciprocity? If we are neighbors and we each do our farming, it will happen sometimes that I need a little bit of help in gathering in my crops, and you need a little bit of help in, weeding or cultivating or whatever, or moving water around. Reciprocity is a social pattern in which I voluntarily offer my help to you, in the expectation that when I need it, you particularly will offer some help back to me. It's not a contract. It's not that we've written out an agreement. 10 days a year, I will support you, and 10 days a year, you will support me. It's rather an informal arrangement of reciprocity, of reciprocal labor sharing. How does it function? Well, it's an interesting thing, because if I tend to be a shirker, if I were to tend to be a shirker, so that when you need me, I tend not to show up, it is unlikely that you, in turn, will provide the labor that I need when I need it. In other words, neighbors who do not contribute when needed, they will find that their neighbors, in turn, do not contribute back. In other words, reciprocity is not altruism. It's not just giving because my neighbor needs it. It's rather a perception, I will make myself available to you in the expectation that you will make yourself available to me. So labor sharing is an example of reciprocity. What's the other solution if I need a little help with bringing in the crop? The other solution is I can hire someone. I can go out and hire a wage laborer for the day or for 2 days. That's a different solution, but if I have a labor sharing practice and it happens that my neighbor has time free when I need it and I have time free when he needs it, well, that is actually a very efficient system. I don't pay anyone. I use my own labor time more efficiently, and I also get all of my tasks done. Community and charity would be another important example of social behavior within a village. Charity means, obviously, giving of money, or maybe giving of food, or giving of other valuable things to people in need. And we can ask, why? What is the motivation that peasant families have in giving charity? What is the motivation that they have in involving themselves in community projects? Maybe cleaning and weeding the lands of the temple or the lineage association building. Why do individuals do that? What are the social impulses? What are the social motivations which individuals have to do charity and to involve themselves in community work? The next topic, convention and coordination, also a very interesting piece of social analysis. In a lot of societies, a good example of convention is the fact that people drive on the right side of the road. People drive on the right side of the road. That's a good convention because it minimizes collisions. If people drove on both sides of the road, then you would have many, many road accidents. So it's a good convention that people drive on the right side of the road. But really, it's no better than the convention that people drive on the left side of the road. All that matters is that there is a way of coordinating activity in such a way that you have minimal collisions. What I find interesting about driving around in China is that that convention doesn't work particularly well in China. There are often people driving on the right side of the road in the opposite direction. I don't know if you've noticed that, driving in the countryside. In other words, the conventions of traffic safety seem not to be completely established. Driving from here to Chengdu, that would be my one example. But in general, conventions are a very important form of social coordination. And conventions are mutually advantageous. We are both better off if we are safe from the possibility of oncoming collision. But other kinds of conventions also. The convention in the United States of leaving a tip for a waiter, that convention is one which serves the waiter's interest. It also serves the customer's interest because the waiter has an incentive to give good service and the customer has an incentive to keep the waiter happy because he may come back. So again, the question, what explains patterns of cooperation and community in a peasant society? You might say, that's not a very interesting question. Of course, there are patterns of cooperation in community. That's in the nature of a peasant society. But now that we've seen the importance of doing micro foundations and providing causal mechanisms at the individual level. Now that we have seen how persistent and difficult problems of collective action are, cooperation and community is a huge theoretical challenge, because free riding and failures of collective action should make both community and cooperation impossible. What we should expect is that there would be a rapid degradation of patterns of cooperation and patterns of community. And so really we've got now a new theoretical issue to confront. What is it that makes patterns of community and cooperation possible within peasant society? A particularly important form of cooperation and collaboration is in the form of protest, collective action, and rebellion. Which in, you know, if you study peasant history in Europe, in Southeast Asia, in China, there are many, many examples of peasant unrest, peasant rebellion, local rebellion, over things like taxes, crop failures, food crisis, a discontent with corruption, anger about land, the one we were just talking about. In other words, peasant collective action happens all over the place in small examples, 10 people resisting the power company, or hundreds of thousands of people forming peasant armies and attacking the local officials. All of these are examples of collective action, protest, and rebellion. And again, now that we are alert to collective action problems, this is a theoretical problem. Why does collective action and collective protest occur? What is it that allows individuals to overcome the rational interest they have of refraining? After all, if a village succeeds in burning the tax records, the tax records are gone whether you were a part of the protest or not. So you have an interest, a rational interest, in refraining from involvement because it's risky. So why is it that collective action, tax riots, food riots, and so forth actually occur? Participation is costly, so why should the individual participate? And before I get to the two theories, here's the China, the relevance of this topic in China. It is the fact that throughout Chinese history in the countryside, but especially in the 18th, 19th century into the 20th century, there were, as you probably know, massive peasant rebellions in North China in particular. There were the Boxer Rebellion, for example, at the turn of the, you know, the roughly 1900. There were the peasant rebellions of Shandong, the what were called the White Lotus or the Eight Trigrams Rebellions. There were the Nian Rebellions, also in Shandong. In other words, there were many rebellions in especially North China. Those were the ones I studied, but there were also Muslim rebellions in Southwest China. There were rebellions all over the place. Question, again, why do rebellions occur in rural society? Not what are the stimuli. We all know that rural society times are tough, the environment is tough, there are landlord-peasant relations that are difficult. In other words, we know what would give peasants a motivation to be rebellious. What is it that permits them to overcome the free rider problem and the collective action problem? And the two groups of theories that we're going to focus on today, one is the rational choice theory, which is referred to as formalism. And I list a couple of authors here who are associated with that theory. The other is more of a community-based theory of action, which is called substantivism. They're funny words. I actually have no idea why these words have become associated with the two theories. The one is a rational choice theory called formalism. The other is a community behavior-based theory called substantivism. One emphasizes individual rationality. The other emphasizes community values. The moral economy theory, which is I'll be focusing on for the first half of the lecture, stresses shared moral values within a village. It stresses conceptions of justice, the idea that we might, if we're members of the village, we might share some judgments about what is good behavior by the authorities or good behavior by the landlords and what is bad behavior. We might share those assumptions of good and bad behavior, just and unjust circumstance. More importantly, it may be that everyone in the local society shares those assumptions, including the landlords. It may be that the landlords themselves agree with the subsistence ethic, that in a time when there is a crop shortfall, it is morally right to put a hold on the rent, to not require the rent to be paid on time. Likewise, the tax authorities may agree with that. So the person who really developed the moral economy theory most fully is a political scientist named James Scott, who wrote a book called The Moral Economy of the Peasant, which is an analysis of peasant rebellions in the 1930s in Southeast Asia, in Burma, which is adjacent to Southwest China and Vietnam, big rebellions in the 1930s, which occurred in those countries. And what Scott puts forward, he analyzes the motivations which peasant individuals had in becoming peasant rebels and involving themselves in peasant rebellion. And he analyzes their behavior in terms of a peasant ethic of subsistence. He asserts that across these different examples of Southeast Asian society, everyone in the community has a right to a minimum level of subsistence, and the elites and the advantaged have a duty to support this right, whether by rent and tax abatement or by charity. So the claim that Scott makes is that the peasant sense of justice is a subsistence ethic, which says that everyone has a right to subsistence, and the structure of local society has a duty to accommodate when there are shortfalls of subsistence. If there are crop shortfalls, if there is drought, if there is flooding, if there is pest, if the crops have failed, then the village structure as a whole has a duty to make accommodations so that everyone in the village gets through. And Scott argues that peasant mobilization happens not when exploitation is high, not when there is extreme inequality between rich and poor, but rather when there is a widespread belief that elites or government are ignoring the needs of the poor, ignoring the duties of subsistence. And this is in contrast to the idea that it is exploitation itself, which would be a more Marxist theory. Marx asserts exploitation causes resistance. What Scott asserts is that it is violation of the subsistence ethic that causes resistance. In a sense, we might say this is a theory of the social psychology of the peasant, or it is a theory of the motivation structure of the peasant. Now, what's interesting to me is that the term moral economy actually comes from the great English historian E.P. Thompson, who wrote in the 1960s. E.P. Thompson wrote a very important book about the history of the English working class, a book called The Making of the English Working Class, The Making of the English Working Class, a really totally important book. He also wrote a book, not a book, but an essay, a long essay, called The Moral Economy of the English Crowd in the 18th Century. And this is where James Scott borrowed the term from, because what E.P. Thompson studies, he studies food riots and grain riots, bread riots in England in the 17th and 18th century. And bread riots occurred when there was shortage, when there wasn't enough food for peasants to eat. And what he found was that bread riots were very structured. They were not just random violence against everyone. Instead, they were very morally regulated, violent efforts directed at millers, the people who milled the grain, at bakers, and at local officials, demanding not that they turn over all their wealth, but rather that they comply with the local ethic. So what E.P. Thompson asserts is that peasant behavior in England was very morally regulated by a moral conception which was both radical and conservative at the same time. It was radical in the sense that it challenged the propertied to live according to a particular ethic, but it was conservative in the sense that it did not challenge the basic property relations. So Thompson asserts that these English actions of peasant activity were not simple kind of undisciplined forms of social violence. They were rather scripted and morally regulated activities expressing popular values about prices and subsistence. In other words, Thompson actually thinks you can read these stories of these peasant uprisings. They're very local, by the way, not big peasant rebellions, but rather 20 people attack the granary and insist that the grain be distributed. That's not a rebellion, it's a kind of a local action. And Thompson, in studying many of these historical examples, finds that they are very ethically regulated. You can kind of decode the underlying values which the peasants were operating according to as they undertook these things. So he thinks that there is a moral economy of the limits of violence and the targets of violent and coercive activity. Before we get on to James Scott, on to Sam Hopkin, what Scott then does with his theory is he asserts that in Southeast Asia, in Vietnam and in Burma, rebellious organizations developed during the Great Depression. The Great Depression in the 1930s pushed many peasant producers into subsistence crisis, because the price of their market goods had suddenly plummeted. Their standard of living was dependent on their producing, let's say, cotton and rice for export. The export prices had plummeted. They didn't produce enough food crop to support themselves, and so peasants were thrown into subsistence crisis. And the colonial regime, the French colonial regime in Vietnam, and also the local landholding elites, were indifferent to those crises. They made no accommodation to those crises. And then what Scott asserts is that it was that violation of the subsistence ethic which led large numbers of peasants to join rebellious organizations, not revolutionary organizations, but protest organizations, which then were asserting the subsistence rights of the peasant. Now those rebellious activities escalated really beyond the intentions of the participants, which is a very common feature of rebellious activity, that the rebellion or ultimately revolution may go to a social outcome which was not at all anticipated or even intended by the participants. Let's turn now to the rational choice side of this equation, and that is a book by Samuel Hopkin, another political scientist, who wrote a book called The Rational Peasant. Both of these books are terrific books to read. I really recommend them to you. I think you would find them very interesting to read. Hopkin's book is based on his study of Vietnam and the organizations which were immediately prior to the beginning of the war in Vietnam, the U.S. war in Vietnam. So the indigenous organizations which led to mobilization in Vietnam, anti-French, anti-colonial mobilization in Vietnam. What Hopkin asserts is that individual peasants decided either to support or to not support these organizations depending on their own calculation of risks and benefits and the likely costs of participation. So Hopkin takes a rational choice approach. He tries to explain the success of mobilization on the basis of organizational resources. In other words, his point is that rebellions don't occur when people, you know, tens of thousands of people wake up one day and say, let's have a revolution today. Rather, they occur because organizations have developed skilled practitioners or agents, skilled deputies who have now moved out into local society, who are coordinating activity, who are trying to get local people involved, and who are then coordinating events across time and place. Well, the upshot of that is that a rational choice analysis tries to give a detailed account of the organizational efforts and organizational successes of organization, which then made it rational for peasants to support those organizations. Now, the rational part is, if the organization can make it credible, there will be a rebellious activity the day after tomorrow. There will be a coming together of tens of thousands of people on the local county official's office, and it will be successful because we've got organizers all over the place. It's going to succeed. You're going to want to be there because it's going to be a lot of fun. That's an incentive. It's not going to be very dangerous because there will be tens of thousands of people there. And furthermore, I can give you a weapon, or I can give you a protection, or I can give you a piece of paper that says, if you're arrested, you're a member of our group and you shouldn't be harmed. Well, all of those would be ways of mobilizing support, and what Popkin tries to do is to explain the circumstances in which those organizational efforts are likely to be successful, also the circumstances under which collective action is likely to fail. He gives a nice use of collective action theory and also of game theory in his account of the ways in which villages either interacted with the French colonial authorities or refused to interact with the French colonial authorities. And you might say that it's a bad idea to cooperate with the French colonial authority. Why is that? Well, local affairs, you would think local people are best advised to keep as much local power as possible. And so people who collaborate with the French colonial authorities are, in a sense, inviting in the activities of the external power holder. And so you might say the best solution for local people is to keep the colonial government at a great distance. However, there may be individual incentives for local power holders to form alliances with the colonial authorities. And so the question of whether a given village or 100 villages allow the French colonial government or prevent the French colonial government to explain the distribution of outcomes, we now need to know what are the circumstances, you know, in each of the villages in the context of which it is either rational for some power holders to go to the French or not to go to the French. And this analysis really depends an awful lot on his use of collective action problems in free riding, also prisoners' dilemmas, which I could explain, but I don't think I will unless you ask. Popkin is deliberately a critic of the moral economy theory. In fact, Popkin and Scott have a polemic for about 10 years back and forth, one criticizing the other, supporters of one criticizing supporters of the other. And what Popkin argues about the moral economy perspective, that it gives too much prominence to moral values. Popkin thinks that moral values really are just too weak an instrument to influence collective behavior, that moral values are highly plastic, and that individuals will find ways of getting around those moral values. His quote here that I have reproduced, I expect to find that norms are malleable, renegotiated, and shifting in accord with considerations of power and strategic interaction among individuals. That, in other words, rational calculation will be more powerful than the working of the social values. There are always trade-offs between conflicting and inconsistent norms. Or in other words, there's always opportunity for the rich and the poor to disagree about the application of the norms, which implies over the long term, the norms will be deformed, will be reconstructed to serve the interests of the more powerful. So Popkin argues that private self-striving, rational calculation and activity quickly overwhelms the motivational effectiveness of the system of subsistence norms. So in other words, Popkin thinks rational decision-making will be the most important dynamic within village society, and therefore the subsistence ethic will fall away. Bakken therefore tries to offer an explanation of rebellion, which depends only on the assumption of rational calculation and the working of leadership and organization as instruments which can change the environment of choice for participants. I'm going back to Scott now for a minute, and to notice that James Scott believes that peasants actually, in a sense, this is a way that Scott agrees with the rational deliberative agency perspective, because he believes that peasants always have a range of strategies of resistance. He thinks that rebellion is a very rare strategy because it's so costly. If you're a rebel, you're most likely going to be shot. And so being a rebel, being a member of a rebellious organization, is a very dangerous enterprise. But Scott makes the point in a study that is called Weapons of the Weak. It's a study of green revolution technology in Malaysia. What he shows is that peasant societies are very smart about non-confrontational forms of resistance. He really takes some delight in describing, for example, when the landlord, who had previously hired 100 villagers to do the harvesting of his rice, the landlord has decided to become modern and is hiring a Japanese power combine to do all of the harvesting. So this replaces the work of 100 workers, 100 villagers. The villagers do things like they cut down trees in the road that approaches the paddy, which means the harvester arrives, but now the trees have to be removed, and so it takes a long time. The harvester is very expensive, so it's sent to another paddy. Now the landlord actually has to hire the workers that he had decided he would not hire. Another example, the workers, Scott gives this great description of a combine that's kind of trapped in a paddy, and the peasants of the village are just kind of standing around the rice paddy as this heavy harvester is sinking into the rice paddy, and they're all laughing and clapping and having a good time watching this enemy of their own subsistence sink into the mud. Now, this is a form of resistance. They could have agreed to attach a bunch of ropes and pull this tractor out of the paddy. Instead, they just sit back and quietly resist. Well, the point that Scott makes is that these forms of everyday resistance are maybe not revolutionary, they're not very dramatic, but they do give agency to the peasant, to the worker. Another example, he talks, for example, about the ways in which villagers can quietly coerce their social superiors. And so the landlord who refuses to give charity in a Muslim society, zakat, I think it's referred to, the landlord who refuses to give charity, where the subsistence ethic says, give charity when it's required. What the villagers can do, they won't attack the landlord, but they will make jokes about him, they will scorn him, they will make rude noises when he passes. All of this is a little bit painful to the landlord, or in other words, it's a way of being a little bit coercive by the weak over the powerful. So in other words, it is Scott's view that the powerless are not really completely powerless, that they have everyday ways of resisting, and that this is true across the board. It's true for workers, it's true for peasants, it's true for university students, it's true for all groups of relatively less powerful people. Nonetheless, they can find ways of engaging in everyday forms of resistance. Another book, I mention it really just because I think his work is so good, but another analysis of the underclass that James Scott offers is in a book called Domination and the Arts of Resistance, in which he really digs in. He tries to give a micro-analysis of the way in which underclass people experience their world. And he takes issue with the Marxist idea, working class people, underclass people, are subject to an ideology which leads them to have false beliefs about their world. No, Scott disagrees with that. He says underclass people usually have a very accurate understanding of the world, but they also have an understanding that there is a public transcript that they need to speak. They need to speak the language of fairness, and yes, the landlord is a very gentle person and very generous. Oh, yes, he is. But in fact, behind the scenes, when they speak with each other, their language is much more direct. He's a nasty person, he doesn't give charity, and he should rot in hell. So his idea is that there's a separation between the public transcript and the hidden transcript, and then there's that occasional brilliant moment when the underclass person simply speaks the truth to power, and those are very dramatic moments. So the application which I've made in the chapter that I've asked you to read for today is, it's an application of several different theories to these large peasant rebellions. I've referred to two of the theories, the rationality theory, the rational peasant theory, the moral economy theory. The third theory is a Marxist theory, a theory by Robert Marx, M-A-R-K-S, who analyzes Chinese rebellion and revolution in 1911 in the Canton Delta, but who argues basically that it was exploitation and it was class relations that led to rebellion. And so what I try to do in the relevant chapter is to ask the question, these are three very different perspectives. I've also left out the religious perspective, the millenarian rebellion perspective. So someday I'll talk about that as well. But the philosophy of science question is, how do we take these different theoretical approaches and then try to explain real social and historical outcomes? And the general view that I put forward is, once again, an eclectic view. I believe that there is nothing whatsoever mistaken about the idea that each of these theories is a part of the truth, that there is a community-based moral sensibility which peasants and underclass people have. And we can say with some clarity how those value systems work. So the moral economy theory is correct as a part of the explanation. Rational choice theory is also correct as part of the explanation. The theory of class with the appropriate micro-foundations, also a correct theory, and then the millenarian theory, the religious theory, the idea that at least some Chinese rebellions come as a result of religious ideas coming from Buddhism, that theory too may be correct. That in other words, there's no need to choose one correct theory because human behavior is multiple. So it's not that, you know, any old theory is equally good. It's rather there are multiple causes of human behavior and human collective action. And by being acquainted with rational choice, moral economy, Marxist theory of exploitation and class, and the religious origins of Chinese collective behavior, by being aware of those different theories, we can now turn to a particular instance, let's say the Nian Rebellion in Shandong. We can now use those different perspectives and sort out in what ways is rationality, in what ways are moral beliefs, in what ways are religious beliefs involved here. And what we will often find is that all of these influences are a part of the correct and full story. We're not compelled to choose. The moral economy and the rational peasant theory are compatible with each other. It is possible for peasants to be both moral agents sharing a subsistence ethic and also rational calculators. Agents make choices within the context of features which involve both community norms and also private calculation. And furthermore, we can provide micro foundations for the ways in which the norm of subsistence becomes causally active. And furthermore, we can provide very specific examples of outcomes where private rationality is the primary influence. So the communitarian village may be the result of rational decision-making by villagers over time who recognize the long-term benefits of cooperation. This is one way in which the two theories are compatible. It can be a rational strategy to be a cooperator within a village which is persisting over an extended period of time. I'm going to skip over actually quite a bit of this material. What I am going through in this series of slides is the efforts which have been made by American political scientists to show how rational choice premises can lead to cooperative behavior. Robert Axelrod is a professor at the University of Michigan who shows that it is rational to engage in reciprocity if you can re-identify the person that you're being reciprocal with, and if you can be confident that it's a relationship that is going on over a period of time. So my concluding views here, the assumption of peasant rationality is a justified assumption. I think there's tons of evidence from China, from Latin America, from the United States, tons of evidence, historical evidence, that peasants are calculating and able to gather beliefs and then choose strategies that suit their interests. However, we do need to make use of the broadened concept of rationality that I talked about in the first lecture today, a concept which takes into account that choosing rationally often means paying attention to the norms that I endorse, paying attention to the loyalties and commitments which I've established, and that we need to have micro foundations for the ways that these values are sustained and reproduced. And that would be the concluding slide. Does it look Chinese to you? It's actually African, I think, but I used it as the illustration on, it's the cover illustration on my book about China, because to me it suggests Chinese agriculture, but unless I'm mistaken, I think it might be an African drawing. Well, that's the moral economy debate, and I'm glad we did it. So any reactions to these, actually, if somebody pushed the button on the chiller there, that would be a good idea. Yeah, it's too hot. Would somebody mind pushing the button there? So the purpose of today's lecture is actually, it's a pretty specific thing that we can do, making use of these ideas about, you know, kind of rational Chinese peasants. We could see how to take pieces of social theorizing, like rationality, collective action problems, the workings of norms, religious ideas, take those pieces of social theory and then explain particular instances. We can see how to bring together the theoretical assumptions and the actual historical experience. So I think that this is a very good way of sort of rolling together the first lecture about methodological localism, the requirement of microfoundations, the working of rationality, and the explanation of particular outcomes. What would you like to comment or add? Yeah, I think we're kind of worn out, actually. So it's hot, and it's been 4 hours of long work. But the great point is you've got now a paper to write. You've got a paper to write for Monday. You've got a fair amount of reading. Could I be confident that you're making good progress through the reading? There's not an awful lot of reading, so I am expecting you to stay current with the reading. Is that a fair assumption, or are you finding it hard to get all of the reading done?